Hello, and welcome to episode 39 of Stories of Strangeness. I'm Zoe, and this is Mike.
Hello.
And today it is a Mike episode, so off you go, love.
Okay. Strap in. It's going to get very weird.
When doesn't it?
This is a real brain melter. This has almost melted my brain writing it.
Really? Yeah. Oh, wow. I'm looking forward to this then.
So this is a tale that I only found out about recently, which amazes me because it's been around for a while, but it's managed to slip under my radar. And this is a tale that involves poltergeists, hauntings, time slips to both the future and the past, odd language, and psychic investigations.
So you haven't just redone Skinwalker Ranch, have you?
No. But this is in terms of ones we've done, this is up there with Skinwalker Ranch and the Montauk Project.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So,
yeah.
This is The Doddleston Messages. 1984, Cheshire, England. The small village of Doddleston sits almost on the border of England and Wales on the English side. It is a blink and you'll miss it type of place. It has a post office, village shop, village hall, a green, a school, and a church and a pub, which are Grade 2 listed buildings. In the 2011 census, it had a population of 715 people. Ken Webster lived in Meadow Cottage in the village, which he was in the process of renovating, along with his girlfriend Debbie Oakes. Ken worked as an economics teacher in a local school, but his passion was music, and he was trying to put a band together. Initially, the pair, along with their house guest Nicola Bagley, observed some strange phenomena in the cottage. Occasionally they would come home to find objects stacked up, usually tins of food and other small items, sometimes over 4 feet high. The occupants put it down to a housewarming prank by local friends. And I have to apologise if you can hear thumps in the background, but our upstairs neighbours have decided to have an elephant parade during the recording of this show. Also, they found tiny footprints on the wall that faded and then reappeared in a different position. Even weirder, the footprints showed 6 toes and sometimes seemed to walk up the wall and through the ceiling. Ken painted over them, thinking them odd grime in an old house. Chalk marks appeared, and the temperature inside fluctuated, often dipping to a chill, sometimes accompanied by a draft that was strong enough to lift a newspaper into the air. Later, they all heard the sounds of footsteps. It was all very odd, and bore the classic marks of a haunting and poltergeist activity. But that was nothing compared to what was to come. Nicola wanted to write performance sketches to apply for an equity card. Ken knew that he was allowed to sign out a BBC microcomputer from the school he worked at to use at home, and did so. The BBC Micro was an early home computer that used 5 1/4 inch floppy diskettes for storage and had a very basic word processing package named Edward pre-installed. It's important to note that this is pre-internet days. The BBC Micro was capable of joining a local network called Econet. Econet was rudimentary and didn't include remote access capabilities, and nothing like the internet-ready capabilities of even a modern phone. The network was often flaky too, and some machines just dropped off the network randomly. In fact, the BBC Micro, although technically high quality in terms of both hardware and software at the time, wouldn't now be able to compete with even a basic smartphone from 10 years ago in terms of features or raw computing power. The BBC Micro couldn't even multitask. If you were running one program such as Edward, that's all you were doing. There were no other programs running in the background. The machine was left switched on in the kitchen one day, and to the occupant's amazement, words appeared on the screen in the form of a poem. Ken, Debbie, Nick. True are the nightmares of a person that fears. Safe are the bodies of the silent world. Turn, pretty flower, turn towards the sun, for you shall grow and sow. But the flower reaches too high and withers in the burning light. Get out your bricks. Pussycat, pussycat went to London to seek fame and fortune. Faith must not be lost, for this shall be your redeemer.
Wow.
2 months later, the trio returned from a drive to find a file called Re8 on the computer. You had to press C to create a new document, not the whole word. None of them had created it, and on opening it, they found the following message. I write on behalf of many. What strange words thou speak, although I must confess that I hath also been ill-schooled. Sometimes methinks alterations are somewhat barful, for they break many a sleeps in mine bed. Thou art goodly man who hath fanciful woman who dwell in mine home. I hath no want to affray, for only sith mine half-witted antic has ripped a twain mine bound, hath I been wreathed a knight. I hath seen many alterations, lastly charge house and thou home. 'Tis a fitting place, with lights which devil maketh, and costly things that only mine friend Edmund Grey can afford, or the king himself. 'Twas a great crime to hath bribed mine house. L.W. Somewhat unsettled by the messages, Ken brought them to the attention of his colleague Peter Trinder, who was a teacher of medieval literature. Peter was convinced it was written in Old English. Messages continued to appear on the computer. The sender signed himself as L.W. and said he lived in the same cottage they did, but in 1521. L.W. believed Ken, Debbie and Nick to be demons or ghosts, and even mentioned paranormal activity in his home, similar to that experienced by the group in 1984. Effectively, both sender and receiver believed the other party to be ghosts. Ken wrote back, and the two time periods traded messages for a while. They asked him who the king was, and how old the king was, where he lived, and so on. L.W. revealed his name was Lucas Wainman, and that he lived under King Henry VIII's reign, and that the king was 46 years. But King Henry VIII would have been about 30 in 1521. Lucas said he could see the cottage and its inhabitants somewhat, although details of how are scant, including renovations being done. But the group in 1984 did not have the same capability to see the cottage back in the 1500s. Later, they discovered that Lucas had apparently lived there sometime between 1543 and 1547 during Henry VIII's marriage to Catherine Parr. He had been married with a son, but lost both wife and child to the plague in 1517. Another message read, Mine friend, pray what strange fury art. Thou I am confused so. Ye be, methinks, goodly, but your lissings aghast me much. Thou say thou live, but thy us not so. If thou lived, thou would say thou know not of mine Jesus College. Mine college be Brasenose, from whence I be expelled, for not expunging thy name of thy pope. If thou note devise unto me, then I must make end to mine words with you. This would cause me much despair. Lucas. Lucas originally said he studied at Jesus College in Oxford, but this was a trap, as Jesus College was not founded until the 1570s. Of course, this doesn't explain how Lucas could have known about the founding of the college around 30 years prior. But Lucas had actually studied at Brasenose College, Oxford, but had been forced to leave for failing to remove the Pope's name from documents. This was in direct contravention of his earlier statement saying he had been ill-schooled. Ken left out pictures for Lucas, which summarily disappeared. One, of a car, prompted Lucas to respond that the carriage would go nowhere without horses, and it returned with scorched edges. Still not convinced that it wasn't some kind of prank or hoax, the group checked for signs of intrusion into the home, but found nothing. The messages almost always came when Ken was out of the house, but sometimes happened when Debbie was in. The group, now including Peter, began to research to see if they could find anything about a Lucas Wainman from the 1540s. But came up short. This hardened the group's belief that the whole thing was a hoax. They tried to corroborate some of the information Lucas had given them, and while some of it held true, some seemed almost correct but not quite, and some they couldn't confirm. Debbie had also experienced several other phenomena while alone in the cottage. Tapping sounds, a feeling of a presence in the house, and even hair pulling occurred. In addition, Debbie began dreaming of Lucas, where she would travel back in time and meet with him, sometimes in suggestive ways, and Lucas talked about these meetings in his communications, leaving Debbie to wonder if somehow she was behind the messages herself, perhaps subconsciously. At one point, Peter half-jokingly asked Ken if their house was on a ley line, the mystical lines of power that crisscross England and presumably the globe. Debbie did some research and found that the cottage lay practically on top of one. At one point, Ken told Lucas that they were from 1984, and that's when things took a turn for the even weirder. Lucas told Ken that he had assumed they were from 2109, like the others who had visited.
2109?
Yes. Lucas then told them of the 2109 collective, one of whom, who was named One, had visited to set up a time link within the cottage and delivered the Leemsboist, or box of lights / computer. Lucas said that One was a green-coloured time traveller. The group then tried to message 2109, leaving a simple message on the computer reading, "Calling 2109, they decided to go to the pub after no answer was forthcoming. Upon returning, however, they had a reply. "Ken, Deb, Peter, we are sorry that we can give you only two choices. One, that you either have your predicament explained in such a non-rhyme way that you may have instant understanding but cause what should not be to happen, or two, try to understand that you three have a purpose that shall, in your lifetime, changes the face of history. We, 2109, must not affect your thoughts directly, but give you some sort of guidance that will allow room for your own destiny. All we can say is that we are all part of the same God, whatever he, it, is."
That's terrifying.
It transpired that 2109 may have been interfering with the messages from Lucas, changing or censoring them. Over the course of many more messages with both Lucas in 1540-something and 2109, 2109 seemed to become more antagonistic and gave Ken the impression that this was all an experiment of theirs, although the reason for which was unknown. Another 2109 message read, "It is better to have no knowledge at all than to have a distorted view of the truth because of your lack of understanding. We, 2109, are not without compassion, but if you continue to disrupt our experiments, then it is likely you will find your destiny. We shall, however, allow one more communication with you so that you may ask your profound questions. We shall answer as you wish. If in terms of physics, then it shall be so, but remember that our limits are set by your own abilities and not ours. There is no one after the man you call Lucas. The chance factor will not reoccur again in a time span you can relate to." Other messages from 2109 described the mechanisms of poltergeist phenomena, and they told Ken that his activities have unleashed this, and they are stopping all communications with Lucas until things cool down. The one called One also visited Lucas and told him something similar. Ken and Debbie then heard from someone else in the 1540s, another Thomas, this one Fowlshurst, the local sheriff, who told them that Lucas had been incarcerated after being accused of witchcraft due to his interactions with the Leemsboist computer. The group also learned that his real name was not Lucas Wainman, but Thomas Harden, spelt Hawarden. The sheriff was convinced to let Thomas knee Lucas out, after they threatened to use their powers against him. Luckily, Return of the Jedi wouldn't be filmed for several centuries, and so the ruse worked. It was around this time that the Society for Psychical Research began an investigation at Ken's request. They came to investigate the house three times, but found no evidence of spirit activity within the house. They could not explain the messages, though, and found no evidence of a hoax either. The group researched Thomas Harden and discovered that he was indeed a real person who lived in that time period. 2109 at that point was perturbed that 1984 had learned the real name of 1540s, responding, "At present, you have two Lucases running around your house. If at any time the two are to meet, We cannot explain the devastation that will erupt in the time continuum. We must stop communication with Lucas One, but we cannot interfere with the other. You must help by giving us every word uttered by Thomas Harden from the second you received his true name. You must also state how much information you have on this man. Everything. Word for word. Avoid any other communication you may have with him. Desperation. Be quick. Ken and Debbie didn't trust 2109 by this point, however, and began to communicate with Thomas on paper. Debbie left paper around the house and found Thomas's handwriting on it in charcoal. Ken then asked 2109 if they can get rid of the poltergeist activity so that they can talk with Thomas again, and received a reply. Yes, we shall hold back as best we can on the PG. Sorry you find us so friendly. Ask the man David what he thinks of conjectural tachyons and what are his theories of causality. What answer does he have for its paradox? Cheers, 2109.
Yeah, cheers.
Ken did in fact know a man named David who had an interest in tachyons and had in fact been giving a class on them that very morning. Further messages spoke of time travel and dimensions. We are in what you would call a tachyon universe, but your understanding is incorrect. We will give you a plotting of a star next time. We move at a speed so that we cover every point in your time and universe. We have no form. We feed of a neat energy that you will not have heard of. The Society for Psychical Research, SPR, who was still in the background of the case, wondered about the house being bugged or otherwise monitored in order to hoax the responses. But nothing was found on a sweep. Ken asked 2109 if they needed a computer and monitor to communicate. They responded by saying it was like two men back to back on top of a mountain surrounded by other mountains. They have to angle their vocalizations very exactly in order for the sound to reach the other person via the least number of echoes possible, so too much of the signal isn't absorbed.
Is that a yes then?
Thomas then sent a last message, saying that he'd been forced to leave his home because the people of Doddleston were very wary of him and planned to burn down his farm. He planned to write a book about his experiences. One day you will all sit down at my table for wine and meat by the river in Oxford, where we shall read each other's books and laugh, and we shall speak of truth and good men, watching Oxford change together forevermore. In your time my book is old, but I shall not go to my God until it is written. Then we will all be truly embraced. My love to you all, I shall await you in Oxford. Thomas Harden. 2109 confirmed that Thomas indeed wrote the book, in Latin, and placed it in a secure area. They said that the inscription read, "Me writes this in the hope that mine fellows will one day find this book. Then may our lands be not so distant." Ken asked 2109 about UFOs, and were told that time, UFOs and most other types of the paranormal are, in some way, all connected. They then explained about areas of contextual magnetism that invoked the lines of magnetism that run around the Earth, with clockwise being positive and anti-clockwise being negative. Where these lines converge on a permanent basis, there can be a distortion of the light/time continuum such that a sensitive individual may glimpse a time scale, which is to say, a past or future event. At some point, Ken was pointed to a man called Gary Rowe by 2109, who was a UFO researcher. 2109 had messages for Rowe, who is important in some way in the grand scheme of things. 2109 had Ken print out their messages and deliver them to Gary without reading them and placing them in sealed envelopes. Gary, apparently, was rather spooked by the contents of the messages and refuses to talk on the matter. So, rounding up, it's worth reiterating a few key factors in the case. Ken borrowed the computers from his school. Various machines were borrowed at different times, making it very difficult to have hacked all of them. Plus, no one else who borrowed any of the machines reported anything unusual. The computers did not retain any information once turned off unless it was saved to the 5.25-inch floppy disk. This meant that some of the messages were lost and or had to be reconstructed from Ken and Debbie's memories. There was never any evidence of break-ins at the cottage, and sometimes the messages appeared while one or more of the occupants were at home. The SPR found no evidence of either a hoax or of spiritual involvement. However, John Bucknell was sent by John Stiles, the SPR's research liaison, to the cottage to investigate. John arrived with colleague Dave Welch, and on a subsequent visit, with Nick Sowerby Johnson. Apparently no report was filed with the SPR on the case, and when Ken contacted Stiles to find out what was going on, he was told that Bucknell had left the SPR in 86, and that Welch and Sowerby Johnson were not members. Just a little aside, weirdly, my writing software auto-completed Nick Sowerby Johnson's surname after I wrote the hyphen between Sowerby and Johnson, which I've never written his name before now, hadn't written it earlier in the text, and there would be no reason to have Sowerby Johnson follow each other, and it did it twice. So I wrote Sowerby hyphen, and the Johnson appeared, and I hadn't had it previously in that text, or anywhere else that I've written anything before, as far as I know.
That's really odd.
Why would a hoaxer involve a future time, albeit without many details about that period? It would only serve to confuse matters and add complexity to the hoax. Why would a hoaxer choose the BBC Micro as a way to send messages? How would they have achieved this? Also, messages were communicated with charcoal and paper, which in theory would require a physical presence in the cottage. Replies would sometimes appear quickly, making it difficult to compose 16th century language replies unless the sender had intimate knowledge of grammar and sentence structure from the time, not to mention some of the more obscure words from the period which Ken and Peter had to look up. The language of the messages is dubious, however. The 2109 messages contained many spelling mistakes and inconsistencies which precluded any analysis of how language had changed in the intervening time, according to a consulted expert. Despite Peter's assertion that the language from Thomas was spot on for the 16th century, and himself being a teacher of medieval literature, Dr. Laura Wright of Cambridge University also analysed the text and concluded that the verb structure meant Thomas made statements in a way people would not have at the time. She expounded by saying, "If it's meant to look like early modern English writing, it doesn't even look close." Ken replied by saying that no academic who wanted to keep their job would say it was real, but Wright conducted further analysis of the incidence of adjectives in front of nouns and found an almost identical frequency between Thomas's messages and descriptive passages written by Ken at 26% and 26.8% respectively, against 32 to 35% in other writing samples from the period. Ken denied authorship and claimed that he was not present for about 80% of the time the messages appeared, often going for a drive while waiting for responses. Ken also stated that Wright and the BBC selected only one message out of possibly hundreds that were received, and that that would not be representative of the text as a whole. How did Thomas know about the founding of a college in Oxford decades before it happened? The BBC actually covered this case in an episode of Out of This World in August 1996, presented by Carol Vorderman. Actors were used to recreate the events, as by this point Ken and Debbie were tired of the whole thing and wanted to move on with their lives, although they did appear in interview with Richard Wiseman later in the episode, but not shown clearly. Vorderman said that Wiseman spoke to two SPR investigators, the second one was not specified, who had chosen not to appear. They had thought it a hoax, but had no idea how it was done. Allegedly, Ken, Debbie and Gary have apparently appeared on various online message boards over the years to state that whatever happened to them was real, but generally offer no more illumination into the case than that. Those messages, of course, could be created by hoaxers. Ken wrote a book called The Vertical Plane in 1989, which is now out of print. Second-hand copies regularly sell online for hundreds. It can be found as a digitized copy, though, such as a PDF. Ben from the Dark Histories podcast read the book and said that the writing was awful, and that Ken spent way too much time trying to convince the reader that he didn't believe any of it, which seems an odd stance, particularly if the idea is to sell books.
Yeah.
The book that Thomas wrote has yet to be found.
Oh, but that's because it's stashed somewhere.
What do you think?
I love it. It's amazing.
It's bat crap crazy.
It's to start off with when you were saying how Thomas, what was his name before?
Lucas
Thomas. When he was saying he could see them, I immediately thought of the film The Others.
Right, okay.
Because
we spent so long
thinking, oh my goodness, there's ghosts in their house. Then we realised that...
She's the ghost.
Spoilers!
Sorry.
No, yeah.
It's been out a while. If you haven't seen it by now, tough shit.
I know, right. But it does have that kind of feel to it that, oh my goodness, I can see things and I thought you were devils. And then it's like, but no, hold on, you're the one stacking my beans.
Yeah, you're the one stacking my beans.
It is... It's really... I love it.
I've watched part of the Out of This World episode, which can be found on YouTube.
Yeah.
And the recreation is unintentionally hilarious. The stacking they do is incredible.
It's a four-year-old thing.
It's not just like stacks of tins of beans or whatever. They have this almost 3D sculpture thing going on.
Wow.
Where things are balanced on like a knife edge. There's like a sieve with a tin of beans on top of that, and then a knife, and then
Was it actually like that though?
So I don't know. I assume it was more just kind of stacked up. In fact, there is a couple of photos that I'll put on the website. One of the real Debbie sitting at the BBC Micro.
Yeah.
But another one where it's a shot of the living room and all the furniture is just piled up in one corner. Now, you could have done that yourself. We could do that in here now if we wanted.
Oh, God, if I could be bothered.
But yeah, can we be bothered? No.
No.
Could you be bothered to do it for a hoax? I don't know. Maybe. Hoaxes are weird things. I don't understand people that hoax things, if I'm honest.
Yeah, because then if you're found out, it just kind of poo-poos all the other ones that could be real.
Exactly.
And everyone goes, oh, well, if you did that one.
And not only that, it's like you're always risking being found out.
Also, I just used the words poo-pooed.
Poo-pooed. And yeah, I just, other than attention, I don't know what people get out of it. I really don't understand hoaxing things and being like, hee-hee-hee. I guess it's that kind of like little shared secret between you and somebody else that the rest of the world doesn't know. And you know that it's not real, ha-ha-ha-ha. But it's like, it's a bit
I think
self-indulgent wank, really, isn't it?
Yeah, but sometimes a hoax starts off as just like a little joke that two people are like, oh yeah, let's do this.
Yeah,
but
then they kind of spiral out of control.
It spirals, and when someone else starts believing and then spreads it, then you're like, oh, what do we do now?
Yeah.
So then you have to make that choice whether you go, oh, it was me, sorry.
No.
Or you go, I'm not going to say anything, step away slowly, disappear. You know, Homer disappearing into the hedge.
In so many of these cases that we cover, it's like, oh, the people that experienced the things hoaxed it. But, you know, from what you glean from them, most of them, don't make any money out of this.
Yeah.
I don't think Ken's book sold particularly well at the time. I think it might sell a bit better now, but he's not getting the royalties from secondhand book sales.
Stuff, no.
And like I say, you can find it online as a digitized copy, which I've already got, but I haven't read because I just haven't had the time.
What if 2109 are starting to like write things in the
margins?
In the margins. Like, yes, we don't agree
with
actually,
this. It was funny you mentioned that because somebody online was saying, oh, you can find it here, and here kind of thing, like pointing to links where you can find digitized copies of the books for, let's say, less than some money, so effectively free. And then somebody else basically replied and went, yeah, but you've got to be careful with like digital copies because it's so easy for them to be tampered with and changed. And somebody else kind of went, who would want to tamper and change the book? And he went, 2109.
Exactly.
So you're like, well, okay, all right,
okay,
you've kind of got
enough.
Me there. But yeah, batshit crazy case.
Really, really weird. Like,
starts off with poltergeist stuff.
But then they're bringing in the two, Lucas Thomas. I'm like, you've got two of those running around. I'm like, hold on.
Yeah.
Two of them? What do you mean? It's like two different
timelines? That could suggest
multiple
time streams, yeah.
And that's why maybe in his time stream, Henry VIII was born at a slightly different time, and that's why the age difference
didn't
matter.
I didn't think of that, but
Maybe the university was built at a different time.
Yeah.
You know? Because...
But it is weird that he basically said... You know, if you were alive now, you would say you didn't know about Jesus College because it essentially hasn't been built. But it's like, well, how do you know it's going to be built?
Exactly.
That doesn't make any sense. That's one of the really glaring things about it for me.
I have an amazing weird fact.
Here we go.
Like, no, the fun fact. But the thing is, I don't know the fact of it yet. So I just need... I have a fun fact
that I don't know the fact of it. What?
Bear with me. I've got to find it. So I've got this weird fact. Okay. That there's time that doesn't exist.
Okay.
Okay. So when we changed to like the leap year calendar, we did it after everybody else.
Okay.
So they'd already done it. So we had to catch up with them.
We as in Britain, yeah?
Yeah.
Okay.
So we lost 11 days in September in 1752 when it happened.
Where did they go?
I don't know. Just into nothingness.
We checked down the back of the sofa?
My thing was, what if that was your birthday?
Oh, gutted. You just don't get a birthday.
Yeah, you just don't get a birthday this year because it doesn't exist.
So this,
but
this
does 11, that mean...
11 days in September, you're stuffed if that was your birthday.
Yeah. So,
wow.
It's really, really weird. So, yeah, everyone else had changed and they wanted to correct it. So they went, right, okay. And they just, yeah. And it says, in order that religious feast dates be held on their traditional dates, for example, Christmas Day remaining on the 25th, Easter is a movable one. So, you know, I'm not going to go into all the crazy craziness of it, but they had to move things. Because like people would be like, well, what about payday? Do you skip payday? Do you have to move payday? What about the year, like the financial year? There was all sorts of things.
Yeah.
It's like they just randomly went, and they were gone, like a poof of smoke.
So, kind of on that note, I was looking at the months being out of order, because a lot of the months are named after Roman emperors, aren't they? So you've got Augustus, Septimus, Julius, July,
but
and
like
things like that.
October, that's supposed to be the 8th month.
Yeah. And September is supposed to be the 7th.
Yeah.
But it's the 9th.
Yeah.
And it's because, apparently, the Romans only had 10 months in their calendar, so it worked out right for them. But then two more months were added, July after Julius Caesar and August named after Augustus Caesar.
Yeah.
So it was basically Julius Caesar cocked up the entire year for everyone else.
Yeah.
And obviously did so because he was like, I'm important. I'm going to have a month named after me and bugger all the other months that are supposed to be in a specific numerical order. So, yeah, it was Julius Caesar that knackered the year, basically.
Yeah.
And I once sat down and figured out that, and I might have mentioned this before actually on the show, but if we had 28 days in every month.
Yeah, we went into that, didn't we? It would all be
We'd have 13 months.
13 months, because there is supposed to be 13
days.
Star signs. And that would make being paid super easy because it would be exactly
be
4 weeks in a month.
Weeks, yeah.
And oh my goodness, wouldn't it just be so much nicer?
January would be a lot easier to navigate because you wouldn't have that long payover from Christmas where you get paid early and then all of a sudden you've got to wait until the end of January to get paid again, which is bloody ages away.
Yeah, I know, but I've never really got that. It's like you've received the same amount of money, deal with it.
You have, but you've also received it earlier in December than you would
so
normally do.
Okay, so don't
spend
it until after.
And then spend it all
after.
On presents.
Well, that's your own stupid fault. Don't spend what you haven't got.
Well, that's easy enough to say, isn't it? But anyway, so I'm a bit disappointed because I've actually listened to at least two other podcasts about this.
Yeah.
I tried listening to a third one and just hated the style of the show and the presenters so much that I turned it off about 10 minutes in.
Okay, that's
couldn't
mean,
handle
but,
it.
You know.
It wasn't
personal,
for me.
Okay, personal
it was personal
taste.
Preference. I didn't like the way they presented the show. There was too many little in jokes and ha ha ha, laugh at us kind of thing without actually giving. I was like 10 minutes in and they'd barely scratched the surface of the information. I was like, this is just cack.
So
I wanted to put a bit more about Gary Rowe in there.
Okay.
Because there was more information about him and about his involvement, and I couldn't find any of it online, and I didn't really have time to sit and listen through at least two podcasts to see which one gave me the information I was missing. But yeah, apparently Gary Rowe was a member of a UK UFO research organisation.
Right.
And when he received these messages, the contents of it freaked him out so much that he essentially just kind of went, okay, I'm done. Nothing more to do with this case. Don't want to talk about it.
Really?
Yeah, literally just backed away. And I think he kind of took a backseat in the UFO community for a while as well.
Do you think there was something that kind of hearkened to another case that maybe he'd looked at? And
maybe. Or just personal information that somebody who was handing him a sealed envelope shouldn't have known, you know?
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, and again, we're in pre-internet days, so this wasn't like you could just Google Gary Rowe and see what he was up to and stuff.
I think nowadays we just assume that if you need to know something, it is literally just there in the palm of your hand.
Yeah.
Like wherever you go. And you forget, like, as a kid, as a teenager, as even as a young adult, if you needed to know something, you had to go to the library.
Or you just went ignorant.
Or you tried to find someone else who knew what you wanted to know.
Yeah, but I mean, used to be going to the library, looking through microfiche of newspaper articles,
piles
and things
of books,
like that, literally
making lists
on end.
And lists and lists and photocopies,
notes,
making photocopies and highlighting shit. And
oh
my God.
Tappy tappy Google and then up pops your answer kind of thing.
Yeah, and it's...
So, I mean, it's kind of a testament to how much the internet has changed everything.
Everything. And it really just makes... So there's no excuse, really, these days for not...
So I was also watching an interesting thing on YouTube, just as a kind of slightly related odd thing, that was saying there's a theory that basically it's called the dead internet theory. And if you go back to kind of the early days of the internet, so like maybe say like early 90s, something like that, it was just a kind of anarchic free-for-all. People just posted their thoughts and feelings on blogs, on message boards, Usenet groups and whatever. And it was just a free exchange of information and that kind of thing. And you know, you still had trolling and you know, cyberbullying to an extent back then. But it was just kind of really open and unregulated.
Yeah. I suppose people didn't realise how big it could be and how it could be used. Yeah.
And basically the idea is that now most people pretty much go to about 10 or 20 websites total. We do research and we go all over the place and find interesting websites and stuff. The list of links for this episode is about as long as my arm.
Wow.
But the idea was that there's about 10 websites that people generally go to, and it's things like Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, WhatsApp, TikTok. You know, I mean,
I
know
they're
all
apps
and whatever. Yeah. But actually, 90% of the content that you see online is created by AI bots. And there is definitely some truth to that, because there are an awful lot of bots out there. And a lot of bots do things like watch for your preferences and tastes on particular websites so that they can serve you adverts for things that they think you'll want based on your preferences and tastes. Also, that basically the internet has become this huge echo chamber, which is absolutely true.
Mm-hmm.
So you go online and you kind of expound your various tastes and interests and preferences, and bots pick up on that and reflect that back to you. Because a lot of the time, when you see stuff online, it reinforces your views.
Totally. Like, you know, I get really annoyed at this time of year because I go Christmas shopping online. I'm going do, and then I'll be scrolling through Facebook, and an advert for the thing that I've literally just bought, let's say for you, is there on an advert, and I'm like, go away! I don't want him to lean over and see this and buy it for himself. Why are you showing it to me? I've already fucking bought it.
Yeah,
it drives me mad.
So that kind of thing happens but not only that, but things like political views and things like that. You get your political views reinforced by content that you somehow stumble upon via Facebook or Twitter or whatever, and these things show up in your feed and you go, oh yeah, I'll click on that. Oh look, here's an article about how paranormal stuff could really be real, and that, oh, that's interesting to me.
Ooh,
and oh, here's a thing about how Nazis are bad, and that I agree with that.
And now
and
we've
I'll
said all of
that,
this and my phone is listening, it's going to be telling me all of this again.
And actually, just when I was talking about the fact that it auto-filled the name of that person, I was like, but this is a word processing app. I mean, it's not even that. It's a markdown editor. So it's very basic text editing. But the website with the guy's name was open next to it. Now, there's, as far as I know, no cross-pollination or whatever
you
want to know.
Cross-pollination.
But it was weird how I put Sowerby, and I don't think I've ever typed that name before, and then hyphen, and it went Johnson.
And it and I just was like, knows.
What the hell?
It knows.
That's so bizarre.
It's read it somewhere before. It's yeah. obviously interested. It's learning.
So the idea is that a lot of the internet is just kind of fake content dreamt up by AI bots to deliver stuff to you to keep you distracted, basically. So it's to keep the population distracted.
Skynet is already here.
Yeah.
And
well, here's one more terrifying piece of information for you. Okay, go on then. So DARPA is a military kind of think group, whatever, if you like, yeah. where they come up with stuff. Now, the internet was originally part of ARPANET, and ARPA and DARPA are linked.
ARPA, DARPA, basically. Yeah.
So ARPA and DARPA, I think they were two separate things, but they were linked. But they essentially started creating the computer network that eventually became today's internet.
Right, okay.
And they did that as a military defensive initiative to try and see, right, well, if we link computers across the country yeah. and a bomb goes off, we've still got quite a lot of connections that we can share information.
Yeah.
We can say what's going on.
Yeah.
Exactly.
It's knowledge, isn't it?
Yeah. Exactly. So it's dissemination of information
yeah.
over a secure channel, blah, 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 yeah. blah. Right? So DARPA also had another initiative.
Oh, God.
Right?
Okay. What?
Which they called LifeLog. Now, the point of LifeLog was to log the preferences and dislikes and everything else about pretty much everybody, at least in the United States, if not worldwide. Okay? And they went, right, what we want to do is figure out some way that people will give us this information. And then we can use that to log stuff. We can use it to root out possible terrorists.
Your band name is
psychological profiling. Yeah. We can use it for all sorts of purposes, both in theory kind of legitimate and also possibly nefarious.
Yeah.
And LifeLog was abandoned. They decided it wasn't yeah. worth it or whatever. It was abandoned on February the 4th, and I think it was 2004, if I remember rightly, and I'm pretty sure I do at that point. Now, do you know what else happened on February the 4th, 2004?
Facebook?
Facebook was launched.
Oh my goodness, what a great guess, because...
on the exact same day that LifeLog was abandoned.
It was not abandoned, they just went...
What a coincidence!
What can we do to make people give us even more information?
And do you know what the best thing they could have done was?
What?
Is if you're a military contractor or some kind of, you know, involved in the military-industrial complex, let's say, for the yeah. sake of a better term, and you're like, we want to log pretty much everything everybody thinks... Does
likes, dislikes.
Likes, dislikes, blah, blah,
what
blah.
What makes them angry? What makes them sad? What do they care about?
In order
oh my
to
goodness,
filter this
it be
information
great?
Through some kind
buttons.
Of AI.
Boop, boop, boop.
Yeah. In order to filter this information to then gain a better understanding of human psychology and how it can maybe be manipulated.
Yeah.
Right? What's the best thing you could do? The best thing you could do is go, we're shutting it down and then farm it out to a private contractor who you can have plausible deniability. If you can turn around and say, it's nothing to do with us, that's a private company, we don't have anything to do with that.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah.
There's a good reason I'd really like to dump my Facebook account, but can't because of business reasons. It's still a useful tool in some ways, but I go on it less and less and less these days. And I post virtually nothing anymore on Facebook.
Every now and again, I'll think to myself,
yikes.
Oh my goodness, I haven't posted in ages, and I'll post something really bizarre and random.
That being said, I post quite a lot on Instagram, which yeah. is owned by Facebook. Yeah. So, you know, I'm not really...
That's it. It's
I'm
all,
not really some kind
all linked,
of...
It's isn't it? There's all these umbrella companies.
Anarchist opt-out that I think I am. I'm not some kind of subversive...
Sweetheart, you are literally like... I don't know, what, 3/4 of the day staring at your phone doing something.
Yeah, but it's not always Facebook or Instagram.
Yeah, I know, but you're liking and disliking, you're watching videos. You're not telling me that there's someone going, oh, he's watched that. Even if you don't like it, they'll know that you've watched it or clicked on it.
And how much of it you've watched.
Exactly. What put you off? Where did you get to? What was the bit that made you switch off? It was that.
Yeah, exactly.
So,
and it really made me laugh. I was watching this video on YouTube about the dead internet theory.
Yeah.
And I was, as soon as it finished, I was like, and somebody somewhere, Google presumably, because they own YouTube, knows that I've watched that, knows how much of it I've watched.
They know you know.
They know that that's something I'm interested in. But, you know, it's also, you know, they're saying that basically part of the dead internet theory is that the algorithms show you more of what you want to keep you engaged, to keep you on the sites that you go to. So Facebook will show you more of the stuff you want. Instagram will show you more of the stuff. So every time you dislike something, the algorithm goes, they're not as interested in that. I'll try it maybe one or two more times. And if they're still not interested, I'll drop that topic entirely and show them more of the, what they want. Now, as a business tactic, that holds up. Because if you want to keep people on your product using your stuff, you find a way to make them engaged with it.
Yeah.
Which is generally show them more of what they like.
Supply and demand, isn't it?
Exactly.
That's like basic business. But
however, that can also be used kind of nefariously at the same time.
The Matrix has you.
The Matrix has got us all. We just, and it is. It's the prison that we can't see or touch or taste.
I think my brain is swirly enough as it is.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so the message, so to get back to the subject, but the messages just stopped when he said, I'm being chucked out of my house.
He said, I'm being chucked out of my house. Yeah, I'm going to Oxford.
I'm going to Oxford.
And
I'm
then
write
presumably because he was in a different physical location to 1984 or 2109 or whichever, wasn't there when he moved. And then apparently the messages from 2109 kind of petered out after that as well.
So
but 2109 definitely seemed a little bit more underhand in their tactics with some of the stuff they were saying. And I mean, I've only included a handful of the messages on here. And like I say, there were hundreds.
So because 2109 implied that these people were going to be doing something groundbreaking.
Big within their lifetime.
Have they done anything? Do we know?
Not that we know of, no. Ken Webster may even be a pseudonym. We're not sure because they introduced him as Ken on the Out of This World program.
Yeah.
But they also obscure. I think they kind of either showed him in silhouette. I didn't get to that point in the program, actually. I didn't have time. But
naughty.
I will watch the rest of it at some point. But I assume they kind of showed them in silhouette or whatever and kind of maybe disguised their voices. Because they were saying, look, we just kind of want this now. Ken apparently had got bored of it quite a long time before that and was just fed up with the whole thing.
How old were they?
I don't know. So I don't think I've found anything about that.
Still about?
Yeah, I think there's definitely still about.
So they've still got time to do something. 1984,
they were maybe in their kind of 20s, possibly 30s, but I would say 20s.
So they're 25 years older than me, so they'd be sort of maybe in their 70s.
Yeah, maybe 60s, 70s, something like that. Maybe. But apparently, they could well still be around and stuff. Yeah.
Interesting. So they could have done something, but also it could be something that happens after they die but to do with them.
Maybe
it could be something as tenuous as their organ donors.
Yeah. Well. Okay. Yeah. I see where you're going.
You know that kind of thing, or the book that he wrote. Something could come of that in years to come,
It could be that they turn around and they prove all of it was true. And then, you know, the implications of that are huge,
mad.
Yeah. I mean, if we can experience time in a non-linear fashion with time slips between periods, that could be huge. Imagine being able to just go into the future or the past and see history or future history as it happens.
Terrifying.
And also an answer to maybe UFOs, an answer to poltergeists, hauntings. You know, they were saying most paranormal phenomena is in some way connected. I think, you know, there are some people that posit a kind of a universal paranormal theory that covers everything. And it could be something to do with either time
is the biggest thing though, isn't it?
Because something like that. Well, there was, I didn't want to get into it because it got quite bogged down at one point, but there was something about the 2109 tried to explain some of the things, and they said, okay, so the time that you perceive as linear we call T1, but there are other dimensions of time, and apparently essentially like the human mind or soul or whatever you want to call the consciousness that resides within the brain experiences time on a different level. So it experiences time on T2, and that's what gives rise to consciousness. But it's actually housed in a physical body in T1 time. And there are also other higher levels of time, T3, T4, T5. It starts getting...
That's
craziness.
I'd have to make a whole lot of notes.
But I'm really intrigued by the one sentence of we live in what you would call a tachyon universe. Now, I don't know the first thing about tachyons other than they appear on Star Trek quite often. But
are they the ones with glumpy heads?
I know it's some form of particle.
I don't think I've ever heard of them.
Okay, so tachyons are some form of particle, but I couldn't tell you what exactly or what they do or how they interact with matter in general. But it might be something that I will look up for another time. Maybe a T2 time or a T4 time.
Oh, shush. I think it's time for tea.
Time for tea?
Yeah.
You really think so?
A cup of tea?
A cup of tea. Okay.
And a biscuit.
Oh, here we go. You always bring it back around, don't you?
No, we haven't talked about biscuits for ages.
That's true. What sort of biscuit do you think 2109 eats?
Well, they sound like they'd probably want something made out of cardboard.
Well, no, apparently they have no form and subsist on a neat energy that we would not have heard of. And neat also was N-E-E-T. So I'm like,
neat.
But yeah, a lot of their stuff had really odd spellings and inconsistencies.
Leet speak.
Yeah, maybe. Well, in the 1500s, I'm guessing that the closest thing they had to a biscuit was just stale bread. Did they make biscuits back then?
They used to have ship's biscuits quite early on, didn't they?
Oh, yeah, that were infested with weevils.
Weevils and maggots and stuff. But then, hey, that was extra protein, so
yeah,
let's go.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You never know. Maybe weevils were good at staving off scurvy until they discovered that lemons were quite good for that.
Cookies were invented in America, apparently.
Really? Okay.
Yeah. That's a story for another time.
The thing is, I still don't really know what the difference between a cookie and a biscuit is.
One's crispy, one's soft.
Ah.
So a cookie generally... The thing is, though, again, I think the UK-US
language,
flip is different as well. So we would say a biscuit for us is something that is crisp and dry and you bite it and it will get
and
soft
if
you dunk it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it kind of crunches. Whereas a cookie is bigger and although it might be crispy on the outside, it tends to be a bit softer.
Yeah.
Whereas... Obviously, it's like it's more name language. Over there, a cookie is generally
what we would call a biscuit.
A biscuit. And what they say is a biscuit.
It's more like a dumpling, isn't it?
Or is it like a scone?
Yeah, something like between a dumpling and a scone, I think, because they have like biscuits and gravy. Which,
exactly.
Yeah, if you did that over here, you wouldn't put gravy on custard creams.
Oh, my
God.
But also the gravy's different as well because it looks more like curry sauce.
Oh, that sometimes sounds pretty good.
Sometimes it's almost white and it just looks like vomit. And I'm I'm sorry.
Okay.
I'm so sorry. I'm sure it's delicious. And actually, sometimes I do just make myself like dumplings and put gravy with them, which I'm sure is quite similar to
probably.
The same sort of thing. But,
but over here, gravy is... brown and preferably if I get my way thick like sludge,
not lumpy though. No,
not lumpy, but just
with onions
thick.
In yum.
You should be able to stand a spoon up in it, put it that way.
It's no wonder we get through so many gravy granules.
Oh my god,
I go
mental with them. No, it was the reason we got through so much gravy before was because I had completely misread the instructions.
You
and thought it said put four tablespoons heaped tablespoons.
I knew that was
and it
the
was
reason.
Four heaped teaspoons. And I've since corrected. So actually, the gravy we had last night was.
That
was
good. Because I did think to myself, this isn't.
Could have
lumpy.
Been thicker for me, but.
This isn't lumpy like it was before.
I like to
understand.
Be able to cut my gravy.
Oh, God. No, to be fair, I like thick gravy. It's the skin that you get on the top that I'm just
oh,
like,
yeah,
no.
You don't like anything with skin on
not
do you?
Custard, gravy, baked beans. No.
Anything with a sauce that congeals.
Oh!
I've actually thought about it before, and I can't think of a positive connotation of congealing other than blood forming a scab, which is meant to heal you.
Yes.
But other than that, there is no good version of the word congeal.
If you can think of a good reason to congeal apart from a scab, hey, let's know. Because just know. But then some people really like the skin on custard and the skin on milk and the skin on... I'm like,
and when you think about like creme brulee, in theory, the top of that is just the skin.
No,
but
it's
been
not.
Made.
No,
yeah.
It's not. The top of a creme brulee, you sprinkle sugar on and you burn it so it becomes
caramelised. I didn't realise you put sugar on it. I thought you just blowtorch the top of the creme brulee and it hardened.
No, you sprinkle sugar on it and you blowtorch it to make that crystal, like, to melt into like...
Okay.
Like crackly
crack it,
crackly goodness.
With a spoon. Yes.
Hey, Mim. Do you want to say hello?
She just did.
Yeah, but it went... while she was licking her chops.
Right, so...
That was really, really interesting, love.
And yeah.
I think and I might have to watch that.
And there's so much more
to
it. And yeah, we'll watch the show, which is, like I say, it's a kind of hilarious Crime Watch style reconstruction of what happened.
Amazing.
But also, like I say, I've got the book and I will sit down and read it all at some point, I think, maybe. Well,
has anybody actually read it? If
you
have, let us know.
Because one thing I'm not sure of is why it's called The Vertical Plane. But who knows? Maybe the book explains it. Who knows?
Okay, I want to know, because we've now done two episodes with Poltergeist Activity, because we have Enfield, and now you've done this one.
Yeah.
I want to know...
Sorry, the cat is desperate to be involved in today's show.
Only just now woken up. It's because it's tea time, isn't it? So, have you out there ever experienced a poltergeist or random movement in your home? I am intrigued.
Stacks of tins of beans.
Yes, who's been stacking your beans?
Or, you know, like I say on the show, they had various items stacked up in an incredibly improbable way.
Yeah. I mean, my sister has experienced a book moving from the middle of her bed. Like, she had a book on her bed in the middle of a double bed.
Mm-hmm.
And when she went to look for it, it wasn't there. And when she found it, it was under the bed in the middle.
Well, my mother used to tell a story when she worked at a place called Healing Manor. Healing is the little village near where I grew up, where I went to school. And my mother worked at the manor house as a cook and kind of general person, orderly. I don't know what you would call them.
Housekeeper.
No, not a housekeeper. No. There was a housekeeper there, but she was part of the cooking staff, but also did other bits.
Just kitchen staff then.
But apparently the place was haunted. And she said that not only did she... Apparently one of the ghosts was quite helpful. Because there was a couple of ghosts, two or three, I think, possibly. But there was one that they had a name for, and I can't remember the name
Ethel.
Of the ghost. No, it was a male name. I can't remember what it was. But apparently he would try and help while they were cooking. And my mum swore to me that one time she was making a dessert and turned around and said, "Oh, where are the strawberries? Where are the strawberries?" And the bag of strawberries slid themselves along the counter towards her.
Oh, my goodness.
Now, I have no idea or not if that's true, but she told it as a true story. And she also said that one of the other cooks once caught sight of this guy in the mirror and her hair turned white. And apparently she would never, ever tell anybody what she had seen. So there's a possible true ghost story from me.
Ooh,
there you go.
I like it. I want to listen to some ghost stories.
Yeah.
Send me some ghost stories, please.
Yep.
So, how are they going to send me ghost stories, Mike?
They will
send them
to you by various messages.
Pigeon? No, I hate pigeons.
Various methods. Easiest way is to email storiesofstrangeness@gmail.com.
We've also got a Facebook page, haven't we?
We do. Facebook.com/storiesofstrangeness after we've just talked about LifeLog and all that. But it's on there.
Log it on there.
Yeah.
Instagram?
Basically, show us your preference and also to the world. Instagram.com/storiesofstrangeness is us, and we post stuff on there as well. I will post some of the pictures of the BBC microcomputer so you can see that, the stuff being stacked up in the corner of the room, and Debbie sitting at the computer.
And we've got a website.
We do. It's storiesofstrangeness.com, which we put all our episodes on there so you can listen to them directly on the website, and we put more information and all the show notes and bits and pieces on there too.
Cool. If they want more content, what can they do?
So if you would like more content, you can sign up for our Patreon. The basic level is £1 a month, which you can sign up for, and we will give you a shout out on the show and say thank you.
That doesn't get you more content, though.
No. For more content, you need to sign up for £3 a month, which is still basically the price of a coffee. So for £3 a month, you get outtakes, you get minisodes, and you get time-lapse videos of the art we've done for the show. And recently, I also uploaded a burp supercut of all the burps that I've cut out of other episodes,
fabulous.
Which is horrifically bad. Don't listen to it.
Oh, God, don't.
Don't listen to it. Don't.
Actually, there's actually a couple of maxi-sodes in there as well, isn't there?
There is, yeah.
We just kind of went a bit mad.
And if you wanted a taster of what our Patreon content is like, there is actually a free minisode that anybody can log on to Patreon and listen to about Erwin Saunders, the Pixie Hunter on YouTube.
Pixie Hunter.
Which is still available for you to listen to.
And there's also another way that you can support us and get a treat for yourself, you know, treat yourself. Yep. We've got a Redbubble account.
We do.
And you just need to look up Zoe and Mike, all one word, and you can find our logo on all kinds of crazy stuff, along with a load of other random drawings that we have done.
Yep, absolutely.
And I think you've already had your fun fact with your lost days in September. So sorry if you did have a birthday in September in 1752. Maybe get in contact with us because we'd really like to talk to you.
If you're still around from 1752, we'd definitely like to talk to you. You're probably the Comte de Saint-Germain, which is another episode, I'm sure, at some point.
Cheeky.
There are also a couple of other ways you can support the show. One is to tell your friends, family, colleagues, vicar,
neighbour,
priest, whatever. Anybody you think would be interested in the show, tell them about it, get them to listen. That's how we grow the show. And if we grow the show, we can put out more episodes for you. And the other way is you could leave us a review. The best place to leave us a review is on iTunes. However, if you'd rather review us on Podbean or Pocket Casts or Overcast or Podcast Addict or whatever the app is of your choice, you can do that too. And we will respond to all reviews.
Yes.
Fantastic content there. Well done.
Yes.
And it just remains to say, apologies for our cat and neighbours, but they're out of our control, both of them. And
much like your beard.
Yes. Don't have nightmares. Or do. I don't know. Maybe you like nightmares. Who knows? And that's it.
We've lost it, haven't we?
Yeah, completely.
It's gone.
Yeah. The plot is lost. Right. So it just remains to say, thank you for listening. We really appreciate it. Bye-bye.
Ta-ta. Love you.